In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In our last interview with Kent Bain, we examined his original investigation outlined in the book Blackjack, The Dawning of the New Great Age of Satan, exposing how the layout of Washington, D.C. reflects the 26,000-year-old processional sky clock, and it appears the alarm is set for 2022. There is a price, however, for getting too close, for decoding the ancient secret language of false flag events or staged violence, and then bringing that sensitive material to print. It's not unusual for authors and journalists in this capacity to be targets of organized stalking. That's part of the focus of Kent Bain's 2015 publication titled Most Dangerous, A True Story. It follows his 2012 book titled The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. And that book exposed the occult codes behind the psychological warfare of the attacks on September 11, 2001. Among the ancient rituals cast is something known as the Golden Jubilee and the Killing of the King, a violent hex meant to destroy society's hope and potential. The book Most Dangerous pulls back the curtain on the pattern of scripted events and occult sabotage, revealing a psychotic intelligence with near unlimited resource diabolically plotting against the destiny of the human race using secret methods. We welcome author and investigator Kent Bain back to the show to talk about his book Most Dangerous, A True Story. Kent, welcome back to Another News.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show. For perspective, you've mentioned that you've worked in close proximity with some neoconservatives who helped draft the project for the New American Century. It's known as the PNAC document, the very document that includes the well-known quote, "Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor." Well, if you would please tell listeners about your work at the Weekly Standard and how there are likely connections and blowback from the deep research you've done to publish the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual.
I was art director at the Weekly Standard from 1995, the inception of the magazine, until March of 2001. And the editor of the publication was William Crystal. He was Vice President Dan Quayle's chief of staff, and he was also the founder of the Project for the New American Century. That came to be seen after 9/11, as you're aware, as a neoconservative cabal that was basically the beating heart of the 9/11 conspiracy. There were a number of signatories that helped establish the project, including a wide range of neoconservative thinkers, movers and shakers, and Bush administration officials and insiders. And without it admitting or denying anything, I was certainly at the right place at the right time to have learned some very interesting things. The Weekly Standard shared office space with the Project for the New American Century. And I left the magazine in the Weekly Standard in 2001. And my first book, The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as Mass Ritual, was not published until September of 2012. But following the publishing of that book, there were a series of events that took place in 2013 that I detail in my second book, things that occurred to me and my family that were a direct result of the publishing of the 9/11 as Mass Ritual. One of the primary events was on the first anniversary of the publishing of 9/11 as Mass Ritual. The book was released on September 11th, 2012. And on September 11th, 2013, on the anniversary, first anniversary of the publishing, I was doing a two-hour special with Conspiracy Culture Bookstore in Toronto. I was teleconferenced in, and we had a good discussion, good presentation. And about an hour later, when I completed the interview and was getting ready, kind of unwinding and getting ready to turn in for the night, my son had his first ever episode with seizures. He had an epileptic seizure, no prior history, epilepsy, seizures of any type. And that was the onset of a whole series of the things that occurred that year that certainly indicated to me loud and clear that there were forces that were very displeased with the material that I had released in 9/11 as mass ritual.
Well, Kent, in your book, Most Dangerous, you bring back the discussion of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and that was a profound turning point in the history of the United States and Western culture. You quote author Michael Hoffman from Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, quote, "What ought to be unambiguous to any student of mass psychology is the almost immediate decline of the American people in the wake of this psychological televised slaughter. There are many indicators of this transformation. Within a year, America had largely switched from softer tone, naturally colored cotton clothing to garish colored artificial polyesters. Popular music became louder, faster, and more cacophonous." Kent, would you please talk about how the death of President Kennedy impacted the public psyche?
It went beyond simply the assassination of an American president, which on some level is just automatically and necessarily going to be traumatic for the public, the populace. What can be difficult for people to comprehend is the use of such an event, the orchestration of such an event as part of a concerted campaign against the American public. In essence, the assassination was part of a very highly coordinated, well thought out, mass scale, trauma based mind control campaign. It was the traumatization of an entire nation. The compounding the initial act, the assassination itself, and all of the subsequent follow up and obsession over every detail of the assassination was the fact that, you know, no one in the immediate aftermath was held accountable. And 50 years later, the official narrative has not changed a single bit. The 2013 marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination, and the debate and discussion that was ballied around in the mainstream media was practically identical to what it had been 50 years ago, 50 years prior to that. And the lack of accountability, the very real awareness that there are actors that have perpetrated this that are completely unaccountable and have not been brought to justice in an intervening half century, that has compounded and extended the original trauma.
Can you look extensively into the esoteric details of the assassination of President Kennedy, including something called the Temple of Doom and the unworthy craftsman connection into this public execution? Would you please talk about that?
I refer to Solomon's Temple as the Temple of Doom in this context, in the context of the assassination, and the lore that is associated with Solomon's Temple, the construction of that. In the Masonic lore, there are three unworthy craftsmen, three assassins who kill Hiram Abiff, the chief architect, and figure is essentially a messianic figure within Freemasonry. And there are many aspects in which the Kennedy assassination, once you begin to dig further and deeper and you look at it from an occult ritualistic standpoint, there are many, for lack of a better word, Masonic elements and characteristics and traits that are very evident to those who've made a study of these things. And, you know, this is not my original research. Michael Hoffman, again, writes very eloquently on this subject, but the three unworthy craftsmen, three assassins, were represented in Dallas as, in human form, in the flesh, as three hobos. They were termed hobos that were present, paraded around, photographed in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, and they were never publicly or officially identified. There's a fair amount of speculation as to who the three were, but that was just one aspect of the assassination that certainly had Freemasonic hallmarks to it and appeared to constitute a very thoroughly planned out Freemasonic open-air mass ritual.
I wasn't aware of the Woody Harrelson connection. Would you please tell listeners about his father? And this information may add some insight to his movie roles and personality.
The identity of one of the three hobos, there's several famous photographs of the hobos, but one of them is very, very likely hitman Charles Harrelson, who was the actor Woody Harrelson's father. And Michael Hoffman writes about an encounter he had with Woody Harrelson. It's very interesting. I'll let the listeners look that up and read about that. But it's the idea of, you know, one of the leading men of Hollywood having a father who was potentially one of the snipers or assassins in the Kennedy assassination. Truth is always stranger than fiction, but given the nature of a lot of Woody Harrelson's roles in the movies, the nature of the movies that he starred in, that could provide a lot of insight in his psychology and his psychological makeup.
That's very interesting. You've discovered some very disturbing things regarding the Zapruder film. It was so disturbing you left it out of the book, but I think it's important to briefly mention in the context of what's going on with child trafficking and a darker agenda.
There are as many theories about the Zapruder film as there probably are about the assassination itself. With a background in the visual arts, I've always been curious about the film, and that there are obvious aspects that seem very suspicious. There's just been a ton of analysis done as I have looked at the film over the years, and you can now access high resolution scans of the individual frames of the film. But in studying the film from in context of a sort of a ritual analysis, or the analysis of the events as a mass ritual, there were some things that I found were just obvious signs of photographic manipulation. And there, of course, is the main image area in each frame of the film. But then to the left of that, where the film loaded into the camera and onto the sprockets, I refer to that as the sprocket area, there are also images repeat themselves that are usually, some part of what is in the main frame, image frame, either before or after a particular image or a particular frame of the film. There are two frames in the film in particular, frames 350 and 351, that contain some anomalous imagery that you cannot find anywhere in the main image area in any of the frames. And They're unique in the film, and as I looked at those two frames in particular and studied them very closely, it became obvious to me that the images in the sprocket area, the much smaller images that are to the left of the main image, that those images had been inserted, and it took a good bit of research and analysis, but I finally figured out that there was an image that was inserted at the bottom of 351, and the identical image was inserted frame of also at the top of 351, and it is a form of porn. It was, in essence, a dirty joke. I went and looked at a lot of medical textbooks, and if you follow my line of thinking on this, those that were responsible for altering the film and in multiple respects, but in these two frames in particular, if they're going to leave a little signature, a little dirty joke, they're not going to put anything in there that's immediately recognizable, that is too recognizable, because then they've tipped their hand. What I believe that they inserted was an image, and again, I think in the book I provide enough evidence to prove my assertion that it is an image of perhaps a hermaphroditic genitalia from either an infant or perhaps even taken in utero. You have to really study these images and study the medical textbooks, and I realize this is, you know, sort of a sensational claim and really difficult to sort of take in, but on one level it's a dirty joke. It's akin to inserting, you know, a single frame from a porn into a Disney film. But then on another level, it is a very intentional, serious, ritualistic element in context of the overall killing of the king ritual that constituted the Kennedy assassination itself. This was a intentional reference to the grand androgynine, the unisex god. And so, you know, on the one hand, you've got a visual reference to the deity of the Luciferians, and then on the other, it's hermaphroditic child porn inserted into the Zapruder film. That is the long and the short of it. I would encourage readers to, listeners to go to my blog, The Most Dangerous Blog in the World, and look at the chapter that I've posted there that it includes this restored information that was not in the book, but that shows the medical textbook illustrations and goes into this whole episode in detail. And I think I proved my point fairly well, in print at least.
Well, it certainly is consistent with embedding subliminal information into footage, so it hits the subconscious and people really don't necessarily consciously realize what they've seen. And on a mass scale, having so many people witness and watch the Zapruder film, a really disturbing ritual element there.
One other point I'd like to make related to frame 350 in particular, you have to remember that this was November in Dallas, and if you study the Zapruder film, you'll notice that the grass throughout the film is bright green. Well, you know, you think of this as what we're well into autumn at this time of year, and the grass wouldn't have been spring green. And you can look at the frame 350 and the other frames, and you can see where the technicians that went in and doctored the film in various places for various effects and reasons, you can tell where they sort of were rather sloppy in a number of places in coloring the grass a brighter shade of green, because that would certainly look better just from a, you know, presentation standpoint, a theatrical standpoint. And you can see where towards the edges of some of the frames they just stopped coloring. Well, in frame 350, the frame where you've got the anomalous images in the sprocket area, the dirty joke, there is a second dirty joke in the main frame itself, and it's an obvious indicator of photographic manipulation. They've colored the pavement green, and Secret Service agent Clint Hill is attempting to climb onto the back of the limousine, and they've colored the area that is obviously pavement that was not grass. They colored the area around his genitals grass green, for, you know, to achieve a certain effect. And so there are really two dirty jokes in that one frame, and they're tipping us off in a, you know, if we don't take this too seriously, we'll see that is a double signature in a single frame in the film. And, you know, either buy that analysis or you don't, but I think I present enough evidence and enough analysis in that chapter of my book that, you know, should be convincing.
Right. So frame 350, that's numerologically the number 8, sun worshipper's number. And then you have green, which is Osiris, I think.
Yes.
And then you have the Thallus, which is, again, Osiris, and then the hermaphrodite. Yeah, so they're trying to get it all in one frame.
And I think they did.
Yeah, it's I don't know what else to say about that.
maybe the less the better.
I commend you on exposing this and getting it out there for people, listeners, to understand this, the level of ritual that's going on. It's surreptitious and undermining. Kent, on this show, we've gone into some depth on the topic of organized stalking. Regular listeners have heard about who is involved and what the victims go through, the esoteric crossover elements, and why this criminal act would be conducted. Would you tell listeners, please, about the organized stalking-related events post-publication of the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual?
Certainly. I mentioned one of the key things that happened following the publishing of 9/11 as Mass Ritual earlier in the interview here with my son's onset of seizures on that specific occasion. But that was just the kickoff to a whole series of things that occurred that year, including apparent use of electromagnetic weaponry, stalking, attempted murder, basically, by an 18-wheeler. I've got chapters devoted to those various episodes in the book, but there were some things that happened that were very clearly orchestrated, and I couldn't say with any degree of accuracy or confidence whether it was gang stalking organized purely by humans or some sort of supernatural satanic element, but anyway, I was glad when they ended the frequency, the number of things that happened that year were not inordinate, but the message was very clear, and I didn't need too much emphasis to get those messages. I think I present enough of information in the book that the readers will agree with my interpretation of events, but I discuss gang stalking in general and some specific episodes that occurred in 2013 related to the things that took place that year. The episodes that affected myself and my family took place against the backdrop of the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. You know, harkening back to JFK assassination as a mass ritual itself, in 2013, the 50th anniversary of that event, it was really essentially a year-long script, a whole series of staged events and false flags with a JFK theme that took place that year. And there were any number of people that were victims of that whole series of commemorative events that were incorporated into the staged events and into the script that were completely unaware of what was happening to them. They were manipulated, by various means, technological, pharmacological, and otherwise. But I talk about that whole phenomenon from the gang stalking perspective and how they could have been induced to do what they did, when they did, and how our controllers have so many tools in their tool bag that they can get anyone to do anything, anytime, anywhere, and to perform on cue like actors on a stage. They can program them as effectively, completely, and thoroughly as you would program a robot. And that sounds, probably not to your listeners, but I think to the average person that would just sound wild and absurd. But I make the case for that, I think, very effectively, and there are a number of specific instances from 2013 that I go into detail to in several chapters. But the psychological coercion, gang stalking component of this, just in general for the year 2013, was extensive. It is a fantastic area of study because you can so clearly identify what the script was, what parts were created and played, and that you had individuals that got caught up in that that were prepped in advance, but that were just completely unaware of what was happening to them, or if they were at least partially aware, they were just completely baffled and just could not do anything other than follow their programming and their scripting.
The Aurora shooter comes to mind. He definitely had that expression on his face in the courtroom. But Kent, you had experienced a nominal gang stalking episode when you were taking your son to the hospital. Can you tell listeners about that?
Yeah, and that was following his September 11th, 2013, the onset of his first seizure. I was taking him to the regional medical center. Was turning off of our local road onto the interstate, and had a little run-in with an 18-wheeler. We didn't physically collide, but to make a long story short, the vehicle, tractor trailer, pulling a couple of trailers, and he trying to rear-end us and run us off the road, and got out of the way, thankfully. And account in the book is much more compelling than what I just spit out there. But in context of the evening and the event, I've never had anything like that happen any other time. People don't try to run over me on a regular basis. They might after this interview, but that was unique in history of my driving career, and it was one more piece of evidence that I was being subjected to some sort of coordinated campaign designed to send me a very clear message.
Some of the information that you're bringing forward in your books is giving people an ability to see the bigger picture and the secret language that is coded in some of these events, these occult scripted events. Well, chapter 32 is titled The Intelligence Non-Apocalypse. And yes, of course, we're being spied on, but the world really didn't need Edward Snowden's revelations to clue people into that reality. WikiLeaks and multiple news sources reported on the NSA, the NRO, and private contractors recording phone and email communication 10 years before Snowden's so-called revelations. But they're called revelations for a reason. Would you please talk about that?
The amount of detail that the Snowden accounts went into just provided a textbook account of how these things are accomplished, but it was essentially old news. I mean, for anybody that had been paying attention, and so then you had to take a step back and ask, okay, what was the purpose of that whole exercise? Well, it fits very nicely into the concept of articulated by Michael Hoffman, that he refers to as the revelation of the method, where those that orchestrate these events and oppress us through various means, they will tell us very specifically what they're doing to us, how they're doing it, and reveal it. You know, in many instances, the events are designed in such a way that they are fully revealed over time, that the perpetrators are obvious, how they accomplish their crime is completely obvious, but then no one is ever held accountable. And according to his thinking, that further compounds the trauma and assists with our enslavement. The Snowden revelations certainly seem to fit that pattern, the model of the revelation of the method, where we're told precisely what they're doing, how and why. And certainly seemed to be what was taking place with that whole episode.
Kent, your book examines a range of hidden communications spoken by global secret societies who are known to be Luciferians, a religion essentially the referenced one world religion, and their rituals are based in astrology, numerology, sacred geometry, and symbol. It can be traced back to ancient Egyptian mystery schools and Druidic culture, but it's a system that now pervades modern human culture, and we're all unwitting participants. Your book, Most Dangerous, shows how it undergirds seemingly unconnected, strange, and catastrophic events. Would you talk more about how you started to decode this language and how you perceive it today?
A number of researchers and authors contributed to my understanding of this twilight language, if you will, that it's been referred to by a number of writers as such. One thing that I found really compelling about what took place in 2013 was it was such a complete, encapsulated sort of case study within all of these sorts of related issues and episodes, and it was really a year-long series of scripted events that were dots to be connected. And once you understood what the theme of the year was, it was clear to pick out the installments and the different episodes and to follow it as the action unfolded across the, you know, the map and the landscape. And to a certain extent, it spanned the globe. There were some events that took place overseas as well. The majority of them occurred in the United States, and a few of them in my backyard or on my front doorstep, which I'd be hard-pressed to explain, but it's all woven in together in the book, and I try to do a good job setting the context for the reader and connecting the dots. But the language that we're dealing with, that we're examining, is heavily based on timing, on, you know, wordplay or name games involving surnames and place names, the creation of artificial synchronicities, if you will. I fully believe in the, you know, the existence of real synchronicity. I think that's, you know, part of the fabric of our reality and our conscious reality. But one of the things that the black magicians do is generate artificial synchronicities that are designed to invoke the blessings, well, to imitate the actions of the universe, but then also invoke the blessings of the darker powers. These can involve numbers, events orchestrated on significant astrological occasions, on the occult calendar. So there's absolutely a sophisticated language that is in play here that is being utilized, and one of the keys to fully understanding it is that it's a lot of times it incorporates humor, dark humor. A lot of times it makes references. You know, a particular event might reference a previous false flag or staged event, or it might reference or incorporate a clue towards a future event that is on the books, if you will. And if you can buy that, if once you come to terms with that and you kind of understand the syntax and the grammar, but not take it too seriously, and understand that there's a lot of fun being had at our expense here, then you can begin you can get with the program, you can kind of follow some of these inside jokes, you can follow these things, and it's, you know, it's not reality television, it's reality programming for the elite. And we're the hapless, unknowing actors. It takes place all around us, all the time, everywhere. It's the real world Hunger Games that we're embedded in. But if you can make that jump, if you can, you know, get to a level where you're comfortable with that, then you can see what's taking place. You can begin to read these scripts. That there are not very many that are as extensive as the one that I explore in 2013. But you know, we're in the era of Trump now, and so it's hard to it's getting increasingly hard to determine what's scripted and what's not scripted.
That's right. One thing that President Donald Trump does say is he's often unscripted and doesn't have a teleprompter. But sometimes he does. I've seen him read the teleprompter. Well, on December 26, 2019, it was widely reported to look out for the annular solar eclipse to end the decade. The symbolism of this partial solar eclipse that creates a ring in the sky is referenced in Chapter 30, titled A Crowning Achievement. And you talk about the crowning of the One World Trade Building with a communications tower that looks exactly like a minaret found on Islamic mosques. And this one is stated to be 1,776 feet tall, 1776, another occult year, but this is a similar mockery with the crescent of embrace, a ring-shaped memorial of where Flight 93 was known to hit the ground. But the ring of fire shapes continue to be woven into films. I recently saw the 2016 movie Arrival, where aliens are communicating with symbols. The main symbol repeated is the ring of fire. A high-level U.S. military actor says in the movie, in effect, "We need one person to represent the world." Kent, in your chapter, you also mentioned the Hunger Games. Would you talk about that interconnection, please?
There are a number of key symbols that the cryptocracy uses and incorporates in multiple locations over, in multiple episodes, reiterate and have multiple variations. The Ring of Fire, the symbol has multiple connotations, but in this instance, it was connected to, that I write about in that particular chapter, it's connected to the completion of this really potent symbol, the One World Trade Center that replaced the Twin Towers, that is a specific height, and it's crowned by this very potent Islamic symbol. And I transition in talking about that to the what has become a well-known or highly used metaphor for the elite, and that was the series of Hunger Games films that were based on the book. You know, the use of symbol and metaphor is extremely important to the elite, and they infuse those everywhere, rub our noses in it, and they, as I mentioned earlier, their thought or idea of us all being contestants in gladiatorial games, the Hunger Games series of movies, was their chosen metaphor for that whole concept. And, you know, we're all the contestants or the victims, and throughout 2013 and then also in years leading up to and then following that, the Hunger Games were used as the movies were used as elements in real world staged events and false flags. So it was not just a metaphor for what the elite are doing to us, how they view us as just entertainment, human cattle, but then they literally incorporated aspects of the Hunger Games, details, real-world details, into real-world staged events, false flags. And I think that the best example of that I can provide is that the author of the Hunger Games trilogy lives in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Of course, your listeners are familiar with what took place then in that location in 2014. But there's symbol, there's metaphor, and there the cryptocracy combines those two to great effect, and usually it's almost invariably at our expense.
For listeners to get a better grasp on the esoteric research you've conducted surrounding the JFK assassination, would you please tell listeners about the Killing of the King ritual and the Golden Jubilee?
The Killing of the King is the phrase that Michael Hoffman and James Shelby Downard coined to use with reference to the JFK assassination itself, hearkening back to ritual killings of fertility rites that involved the sacrifice of kings and elites in previous centuries. The elements of these rituals are multiple, and there are any number of ways that you can identify the elements in the JFK assassination itself, the original act. And in looking back, you can find symbols in the landscape. You can look at the timing of the assassination, the date, and there are so many ways that the ritual was woven together, from the location of the ritual itself, Daly Plaza, which was the site of the original, the first Freemasonic Lodge in Dallas, and was named after 33rd degree Freemason. Moving, you know, there were obelisks, there were reflecting pools, there were five-pointed stars. Daly Plaza was essentially an outdoor ritual temple, and I dissect that in multiple chapters in Most Dangerous, a True Story. But moving forward into 2013, which was the 50th anniversary, or as I refer to it, the Golden Jubilee of the killing of the king, there were the ritual elements scattered throughout the scripted events for that year that harkened back to what took place in 1963.
Listeners would need to get an idea of the 12 days of terror that you've chronicled. These are instances of false flag operations, sabotage, JFK references, and ritual mockery. Would you please give some examples of what this is and how you began to focus on it?
Well, of course, that was a takeoff on the 12 days of Christmas, but there were, as I've stated, there were a whole series of things that occurred in 2013 that were part of this 50-year commemoration of the killing of the king, and the commemorative activities were every bit as well thought out and planned as the original ritual in Daly Plaza in 1963. I devote a number of chapters to the episodes that led up to the official observation on November 22nd, 2013. There were events that took place all over the United States, and in some instances, in other countries across the globe. They touched on various aspects or elements related to JFK history, in some episodes to his brother and his family. There was a lot of creativity that went into this. And again, it's a lot of it is, you know, just is dripping with this dark humor. And if you fail to miss that, or if you can't buy that, then, you know, absolutely don't read this book, because you will be extremely frustrated. And it's I have to constantly remind myself not to take all this too seriously, because even though it's involves life and death and the manipulation of the entire human population, those that are doing this have a wicked sense of humor. And that you find that in the events that lead up to, you know, there are main events, there are sideshows. One of the events, the key events of 2013, that was absolutely part of the commemoration of the JFK's assassination were the Boston bombings. And, we could, devote an entire show just to the Boston bombings, and then how the bombings connected to Kennedy, and then to things that had taken place earlier that year, and then following the bombings. But that was, in addition to being a major false flag, one of the major false flags of the last decade, that was also one of the key elements of the Golden Jubilee of the killing of the king. And I do, in the book, Most Dangerous, a True Story, make it very clear how there was a walk up to the Boston bombings, and there were hints and clues, and then following that, it was the kickoff for the remainder of the year, from April forward, for events that connected to it. And the just as a for instance, of course, the Boston bombings took place in Boston. Then there was, about a month later, there was an episode that was completely completely obvious how it was connected, but took place in New Boston, Texas. And that's the kind of thing you find, those sorts of connection clues, hints, and inside jokes. And so it might appear from a superficial perspective to be just scattershot and all over the map, and you know, how in the world does all of this connect? But when you understand the language, you understand that there's a language that involves geography, dates, names, places, and you understand that language and the grammar and the syntax, you can make perfect sense of this, and you can follow it with high degree of accuracy.
Another Hollyweird name is James Franco. A key actor on the ritual stage, he connects into the larger symbolic script with his choice of projects, such as Oz. Would you talk about his work, please?
The cryptocracy regularly incorporates individuals who are either, you know, willingly involved, complicit, or just participating without any clue as to what they're embedded in or involved in. That was the case in the 9/11 mega ritual. It's just a frequent component that you can identify as you do autopsies on public rituals and staged events. In 2013, James Franco seemed to have been one of the key figures that they used to connect some dots, and he was present physically or symbolically in a whole range of ways throughout the 2013 script for the Golden Jubilee of the killing of the king, and he kept popping up in various locations, and couldn't necessarily speculate as to the degree of his insider knowledge, but he certainly seems to have been in a wide range of places and of events that took place that year. So he was one of the key figures in the 2013 script. And a comparable figure would be the 2001 mega ritual. U.S. Solicitor General James Olson I referred to him in a chapter dedicated to the topic on as the 9/11 birthday boy. His birthday was September 11th. His wife was a popular CNN commentator, and he was in a very specific location, specific time, played a very integral role. And as I detail in the book, it just defies credibility and logic that it was by chance and it was just all synchronicity. He was someone who was very intentionally incorporated into the entire ritual and then ended up being very highly rewarded for his role in subsequent years in legal dealings following 9/11. But so there are individuals that fit that profile that are key actors in the scripts, and sometimes you can say yes, they were knowing participants, and sometimes it's hard to tell what they knew, how much they knew, and how complicit they were. But the James Franco certainly fits that mold, and it makes regular appearances throughout Most Dangerous, the True Story.
Kent, when you connect synchronistic dots with the dates of those who pass away, and those dates happen to be on occult holidays or notable times, most would say, well, this person was going to die of old age and bad health. It was more likely coincidental. What are your thoughts on that perspective?
You could certainly make that argument, but in looking at mass rituals, staged events, and the patterns, the numbers, the dates, symbolism involved, what you begin to realize is that, you know, of course, people die for a variety of reasons and certainly of old age, but there are a number of episodes that I've studied that you can point to where someone of high symbolic value passed away at a precise opportune moment, and pushing an aged or infirmed individual on through the door is an even easier task, I think, than executing, sacrificing someone who's in perfect health in the prime of their life. People tend to ask fewer questions. They're certainly not a moving target. You know, there are lots of reasons not to look any further for an explanation when someone who's in their 70s, 80s, 90s passes away. But in the book, I've referenced several mass rituals where there was clearly an ongoing staged event pinned to a particular date, and this was the case with the JFK assassination, and you had other elements that were off-site, kind of second stage, that fit this pattern. A lot of people don't know that both Aldous Huxley and C.S. Lewis passed away on November 22nd, 1963. And again, they were both in their later years and in poor health, and you could accept conventional explanation that they passed away from illness or old age. But I make two chapters making a good argument for why their deaths were intentionally timed aspects of the broader ritual that occurred that day. So it was not just the ritual killing of the world's most powerful leader, the physical embodiment of hope, John F. Kennedy, but there were also two accompanying episodes, each that made their own extremely powerful statement that reinforced the message of the day that the Kennedy assassination was going to bring about a brave new world.
Joan Rivers may fall into this category because her death was suspicious, in my opinion. It occurred days after comments she made about President Barack Obama and the First Lady, Michelle, to the effect that she said that President Barack Obama was gay and that the First Lady, Michelle Obama, was a transsexual.
Absolutely. She made one off-the-cuff comment too many and about the wrong people. And she had made a career out of saying very controversial, inflammatory things, but she said wrong thing, wrong time. And I think it was just a matter of days after she made that comment to a member of the press. She was undergoing it was either routine surgery or cosmetic surgery, and there were some unforeseen complications, and she passed away then and there. And as it happened, her personal physician was present at that procedure. He was not performing the procedure, but I speculate in the book that he or someone else in the room might have snapped a photo of the recently deceased and emailed it to someone and said, "The mission accomplished," perhaps email address in the White House at the time. I mean, I always stand back at some point and say, okay, was that engineered? You know, did I not pull back, you know, quite far enough? Did I miss the level that this was really operating on? It certainly would make sense that, you know, she, you know, took pot shots at the left's, you know, savior at the time and his partner, Barack and Michelle, and I just took it too far and then paid the ultimate price. But you have to be so careful because you can't perceive everything as the result of a conspiracy and as staged. But when you see how much they have done and know that they can stage anything, you have to question everything. You don't have to spend all your time questioning it. But, you know, it certainly appeared that she just got whacked for running her mouth. But who knows? That might have been part of the programming for that week or that month, and she might be alive on a Caribbean island today.
The book is titled Most Dangerous, A True Story, and author Kent Bain has been our guest, decoding the secret language of scripted events unraveling in the face of society every day. However, by speaking about this properly, a vital consensus reality can take hold to help expose and stop the continued ritualized attacks launched on populations of people. Kent, if listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about your work, how would they do that?
They can visit Trinday.com, the publisher of all three of my books. The first is Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as Mass Ritual. The second is Most Dangerous, A True Story. And my most recent book is Blackjack, The Dawning of the New Great Age of Satan. I have a blog page and a Facebook page, and listeners can Google those as well.
Kent Bain, thank you again for being on In Other News.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the...